January 20th, 1983, Long Beach, California. Charles Armin, interviewed by Kay Brigo.
And these local union leaders decided that they were going to take the oil industry on the West Coast. And they said, first, they were going to stick to the 25 cents. And then some guy, who happened to be the secretary of Local 128 at the time, and a young guy who I had a little bit, I thought was a pretty smart kid, young man. But he was that bad. He takes the position, well, no use of us just, if we're going to strike them, no use of us striking them for 25 cents, we ought to demand 30. And so they discussed it. And they decided to demand 30 cents an hour. Now, the man who was our district director was a man named Elroy Brown, and he had two representatives on the West Coast. It was a guy named Jimmy Morgan and myself. And we were bargaining, I mean, we were the International Union on the West Coast at that time. We opposed, at least Errol Brown and I did, mostly he did, because he was our spokesman, but got up and spoke against the strike thought. It was very foolish. In fact, I know I got up on the floor and told them that I was quite certain that I could get a 17.5 cent offer out of Texaco if we had given the indications that that would be acceptable. In other words, we would accept exactly what they accepted in other parts of the United States. Well, no, they weren't going to do that. They voted not to. Well, we left, came back, we got in our negotiations, and we ended up having a strike. It was 16, for a month and a half, we had a very good strike, very successful strike. Up for that length of time. Our people were enthusiastic, they weren't short of money. We hadn't gone through any real hard times since the war, and they'd had the money they accumulated. So everybody was pretty comfortable, and they thought that the industry would crack. But the industry didn't. They got stronger, we got weaker. When a picket line ends up in maintaining itself by having violence occur, you realize something's slipping. You don't have to have violence when the people are in support. Something's happening that has to be looked at. Well, this was beginning to happen. We had groups that were trying to come down and having rump session meetings and trying to force a settlement. And the oil industry began to use the Taft-Hartley law, which had been passed a year earlier. We were one of the first unions to feel the impacts of what some of those things could do. They engaged in practices which prior to the Taft-Hartley law would have without any question been considered unfair labor practices. But they did them. They read the law more carefully than we did. We had our people on the picket lines faced with trucks driving up full of court orders, and they began to hand them out like they'd hand out Valentine's. Suing the individuals in the unions for $35 million. And they went through the same thing I went through when they had their first experience in getting sued. Now, they were worried. Some of them owned houses and things, you know. They'd been working for quite a long period of time and were fairly well secure for a working guy. They'd been on good wages and things like that, and this frightens them. The more you have, the more you get frightened on something like that. And our people, not all of them, but there's a lot of members in our union that weren't that well off, but especially the person who's been around the oil industry. It had been a good industry in the sense of its economic security. And so they were worried about it. They didn't want to admit it, but you could see it. You see it in their faces. You could hear the talk between the groups. You see little groups getting together. And it became evident that soon we were going to have to do something, because what was happening is that the few people who were quite militant and couldn't see anything else to do, begin to use tactics which was getting them into trouble. And the company was firing them for activities. When an activity is done on a picket line that's very spontaneous, usually nobody gets harmed too much. It's accepted for what it is. But when it happens away from the picket line, in a situation that doesn't look to be unpremeditated, people get into trouble. And so it was not just what the Supreme Court used to define as the animal exuberance of the picket line, but this was beginning to be violence in the sense of violent acts being committed that were in and of themselves illegal acts and were not considered associated with this excitement of a strike by the company and, unfortunately, also by the people who were going to interpret these actions subsequently to courts. No place to take those things in the courtroom. So our strike began to deteriorate. The company could replace economic strikers, which they couldn't used to do. They could come in and hire brand spanking new people. That is, they used to be able to replace you, but they couldn't permanently replace you. When the strike was over, you got your job back. And the guy who came in and stole your job, the scab got fired, you know, got let go. Or the company had to carry an extra man, you know. You had your jobs back, unless you had been guilty of one of these acts. But here the company had brought in whole groups of people to take the jobs, and so many of our people didn't have jobs to go back to. And this magnifies as the time goes on. The problem doesn't get less, it gets worse. And then you get locked into positions where there's no settlement, you know, because if you say you can't go back, unless you all go back, and the company doesn't have room for you all, won't take you back, then you're pretty much in a tough spot. They had done an additional thing. The Union Oil Company had hired a contractor to come in and do all of the maintenance work of their plant. And they had found a contractor who was an organized contractor under AFL contract to come in and do that work. This was prior to the AFL-CIO being in their merger, which in some people's minds made a difference. Morally, to me, it didn't make any difference. But then it's too late to be passing judgment. It was an event that happened. It occurred. They took those jobs and were not prepared to leave them. And the company could have solved it easily had they wanted to and just simply said to the contractor, "We're not through with you. We don't want you anymore. We're going to bring our own people back." But they didn't do that. They wanted to keep the contractor there for the purpose that if they ever had another strike, they have a readily available source of strike makers, of scabs. So we had a case where we had half of our workforce at the Union Oil refineries, one here in Los Angeles and the one in Richmond, or in Rodale, didn't have a job to go back to. So they weren't real anxious to vote, "Yes, let's settle the strike." We had a guy by the name of Jim Thornberry, who was an international representative. I don't think I mentioned him. He was with Jim Morgan and myself. Was an international representative who was working with that Union Oil Group, and he was one of these guys that on occasion he just seemed to come up with something out of, you know, a way of doing things. And he did in this case. He worked out a settlement. It was nothing that the union could stand up and crow about, but it was a way out of a very, very tough problem. Cost the company a lot of money to do it, but they realized they had to get it settled sooner or later too, but it didn't eliminate the contractors. But they formed a work pool, and many of our people who had jobs as stillmen and stuff like that went back and worked as laborers, cutting weeds and cleanup and janitorial work and things of this nature, if they wanted to go back. As a result, you know, some of them didn't go. They wouldn't accept that. The craftsmen, none of them went back. They, most of them, of course, could find jobs other places, but they lost that service record that they had with that company. But many of them had gone to work after the strike, not during the strike, but many of them got jobs for those contractors. So they worked at the same place, never lost a day's work except during the strike, working for that same place, but they lost all of that service and their pension equities and things of this nature. We had an experience there that demonstrated to me, I think it kind of set my subsequent philosophy towards such things. You have to be prepared to strike and ready to strike. You have to be sure your issues are quite clear that people understand them and really know what they're striking about and are ready to support them. And the issues have to be the kind that are subject to being resolved. They can't be... They've got to be pretty practical issues as opposed to theoretical issues or philosophical issues. Very difficult to solve them. Or you have to be in a position that you know that you can seriously cripple the operations of the company. Be effective, in other words, in what you're doing. It was no longer just good enough with the laws being changed as they were under Taft-Hartley, with the company having rights that they never had before. After the Wagner Act was passed, they had them before that, but the ability of the company to sue an individual, replacing, do those kind of things, you know, that make that person really not free in the sense of making his own decisions, fighting his battle, have to be weighed very carefully. Especially in an industry which is a continuous process industry, which is more dependent upon a machine to do the work than it is the manpower that does it. Supervision can come in, and if everything is running right, operate a refinery for a considerable period of time, and until actually something happens which requires a shutdown of that facility and bringing in all the maintenance personnel, it's pretty hard to be effective in a strike. And as automation takes over, to where now they're computerizing these refineries to the extent, I don't know if that's a good word, but it's used, I guess. But putting the refineries under operation guided by a computer, then the need for the hands being present constantly is less and less. And a union striking power is only in the value of the hands, the need of them to be on the job. And so the total balance of power, how a union operates within the petroleum industry, begin to change substantially. Now, this is true in all industries, but we felt the impact of it quite early because the astuteness of the industry to get involved in computerization, mechanization and computerization, automation was substantially ahead of most of the other industries. The automobile manufacturers got into it finally when they began to turn their assembly lines into this. They were even beginning to drill blocks by automation. And I can still remember what Luther said the first time he went through one of the General Motors or Ford plant or whichever one it was, I don't remember now, where they were demonstrating very proudly their new automatic drill system, you know, their computer, or not computerized, but automated drill system. And you have to ask them just one question. How are you going to sell a car to that machine? You know, this probably is the biggest mistake that industrial America has made, in the sense of it has moved itself into a high technology, a computerized industry with little need for manpower, but have done nothing to find purchasers for their equipment, their product. And it isn't that the people don't have the desire, they just don't have any chance. You know, an unemployed worker doesn't buy much except the necessities. So this happened in the oil industry. Now we're beginning to see it. The automobile industry, the tire industry, the steel industry are feeling tremendous impacts because they're going through now. We're here right during the heart of all this depression. General Motors just announces again that their Fisher Body plant in some town back in the Midwest that is the biggest, the highest level of unemployment is going to lay off another 3,000 workers because they're going to combine two plants. And they can say this frivolously in their sense because it's an economic thing for them to do. They think, quickly we're going to be able to understand that it isn't always economic to do things the least expensive way, maybe, until there's some new thing developed, a new understanding of how to, instead of paying out wages in the steel industry, that money is somehow distributed into the economy so they can make jobs elsewhere. The money can only come from production. The nation's income comes from its total production. There's no other way of getting it. It isn't dollars and cents. That's nonsense. But people think it is. That's a mistake we make, I guess. But when they speak of gross national product, that is a significant thing. And it sometimes gets way ahead of the purchasing power, which is what's happening now. It's still possible for a farmer to go out with one man with these new tractors and new equipment and facilities that he has available to him to plow twice as much ground, plant his crop, and if the good Lord is good to us and the crop grows, the harvest is excellent, to grow more grain, in other words, with less manpower. But if there's nobody to buy it, it doesn't work anymore. It was when he made half as much, you know. So we've got to find some way. The union's job is going to become, I guess what I'm trying to get at, is the union's job from this point forward is going to have to become more and more political in nature. The decisions that are going to be worthwhile, the union making, isn't to demonstrate how strong they are in relationship to a particular employer. And to be able to get them crow and say, this is what I did. I showed that guy. You know, this type of thing that has been going on more or less in the industry, all industries, over the years, has got to change. That isn't going to solve or resolve any of the problems, the major problems we've got. We went through the cycle after World War II where unions struggled, pushed for raises, which they had to do to try to keep up with the cost of living. But recognizing full well when they got into those negotiations that if, like we did in the oil industry, that although we could get a dollar an hour wage increase for everybody in the oil industry from the president of every company down to the latest hired person, and that would only raise the value of the gasoline by 2 cents a gallon, we knew that 2 cents a gallon wasn't the what they were going to attach to that. They were going to attach 4 cents or 6 cents or something else. And we recognized that. We had no way of controlling what they did. Any more than they had more control over what they gave us because they could take us on in a battle. But the system built just a stair-step, leapfrog program. I don't know who to blame, because I don't know which is the chicken and which is the egg, you know. When you look back at it, we always could demonstrate to ourselves, justify, in other words, what we were doing, based upon the fact that even though we had gotten this, and it was more than maybe other workers had gotten, and usually we did pretty good during those days, on the amount we got, We didn't do it because of our own particular know-how and brain power. We did it because we had one of the richest industries in the world, who sometimes would rather pay just a little bit more in order to get out of the embarrassment of running into problems. Especially if they crept with their hand in the cookie jar with OPEC or somebody, you know. They didn't want too many forces against them at one time. But we would justify these things we were after on the basis that we were getting our purchasing power hadn't gone up to that extent. So, we had some recognition of it. We usually just shrugged our shoulders because we didn't know what to do about it. We tell our members to get involved in politics and they elect Reagan. Because he supports tax cuts. Here in this country, one of the possibly the most wealthy countries in the world because of our technical know-how, our resources, the size of our country, the fact that we can take desert land and make it arable. We can move water over great distances. We have water if it's properly distributed. Not in the amounts we'd like, but we can do that. We can take ocean water and make it into water that can irrigate land. And we have the knowledge to do it if we're willing to pay the price. And maybe we can't afford not to do it, you see. Barry Goldwater at one time, in testifying against the building of all of those dams and the irrigation projects on the lower Colorado, said we can't afford it. The price of the land will go up to $2,000 an acre. Nobody could buy it. Well, surely $2,000 an acre at the time he said that was sounded like a tremendous amount of money. But look at what that land does in the way of taking land that was useless, using water that went into the ocean, and is now making that land valuable to where it's worth, what, $20,000 an acre? I don't have any idea. You can't measure when you take something non-productive and make it productive over an expanded period of time. You can't measure the value of that. No business would have denied building that because they would have seen that future asset and they would have borrowed money to do it. And yet, we have people who today are saying we can't afford certain things. We pay a person in welfare, let's say $100 a week. I don't have any idea what we pay, really. But suppose we just outright gave them $100 a week. Or $100 a day. And we found a place where we could work those people, and it would cost us $125 a day, but we hired them over here. And once they become hired, then they pay taxes. They become part of the working population. And when you add up this what they pay back, taking them off of this role and put them over here, when you talk about the gross national product, which creates all the value, nothing else. And welfare comes out of that, as well as everything else. That we can do this, instead of at a public cost of $100 a day, we can do it at a public cost of $75 by doing it this other way. It's cheaper to work them than it is to do it this way. The creation of jobs and keeping people productive no matter what they're doing, if they are contributing to the increase in the asset, or something that is increasing the production, and we've got millions of jobs like that, would be able, you couldn't talk. You couldn't possibly say we can't afford not to do it, can't afford to do it. Example, and this is the kind of thing I think the unions have to get involved in. Railroads. We have the worst railroad system in the world for a country like ours. I had the good fortune to be in Europe a year and a half ago, 2 years ago. And I got a Eurail pass. So I went over. It was only a 15-day Eurail pass. But I had 15 days I could ride any public transportation system in Europe. all countries of Europe, not just Germany or not just France, but all of them. The railroad system is interlaced better than ours is between states. We have more restrictions between states than they do between countries, in many ways. But I saw a system of railroads which would travel almost to the maximum. Very few times did you get on a train, and it wasn't full. And we were riding first class. On a railroad pass, you can ride first class, second class, or steerage, or whatever. You know, they really have just the two classes. But you can. They encourage the people on the rail to go first class because the second class is totally utilized. Once in a while, there's a vacant seat on first class. People move. Large numbers of them move. The kids. Kids here that are hitchhiking along the road with a pack on their back to get places are riding the second class train there. They are like dormitory cars, you know, bunks and bunks and bunks, you know, and it's a sleeper. We even had second class passengers laying down on the floor of the first class, you know, in the aisle to find places to sleep. They were that full, especially when you were going up into the Switzerland, or a place where they were going to go up to hike, or, you know, this type of thing. The best trains were operating on road beds that were smooth, between countries. We took a first class from Paris to Amsterdam, and we caught the little local and rode out to little cheese-making city. So we spent the night. We didn't want to stay in the big town. So, you know, we went Abfort, I think. No, that isn't right. No, it isn't important. But anyway, we rode the... It was like a... Not wasn't a two-wheel trolley. It was a good train. But it was local. The seats were not quite as comfortable. And there was no sleepers, accommodation. But we rode from 20 miles, 30 miles out. And next day, after we'd spent our day in the little town, we'd get back on that little thing, ride back into Amsterdam, catch the train to Cologne. This is the kind of accommodations that they have, the train system. Anybody rides our train and see what kind we have, and see that there's no service, the road beds are bad, there's always having derailments and things of this nature. And not caused by acts of God, like an earthquake or an avalanche, which creates problems, and especially over in the mountainous areas. Yeah. No, it's caused because the rails have come apart. Or somebody maybe sabotaged them, I don't know, but that's probably not very much of it. But just think what would happen in this country if we decided to make our railroads good transportation. A public service, you know, public utility. I don't think you could say there's a too big of a cost to pay to do that. First of all, the cost wouldn't be so great because look at the number of people you'd put to work. You have to have the laboring crews to build the rail beds. Again, make the tracks good. You have to take out all the old type tracks and put in the welded track, solid steel welded track. They'd have to have your plants open up to rebuild railroad equipment and get good rolling stock. They'd have to have continuous crews to maintain the roadbed. Adequate. Not just adequate, but well. They would then begin to have transportation, and they'd have to open up that to all of the areas so that people could get from here to there without having to go by the way of Jones's barn. And then when they did that, look at the kind of transportation we'd send. You could then have adequate transportation that would take, the Teamsters Union wouldn't like it, because it would cut down a lot of trucking. Not all of it, because you have to still get from it to the train. But it would eliminate long-haul trucking. But it would take the, not just the transportation of things, but people. anybody who ever rode the old red cars in Los Angeles knows what people movers can do. What the New York subway does in moving people. If we put the same effort in that, we could take a tremendous number of the unemployed and put them to work on that in jobs that most of them could already do. They're already trained. A welder can weld track just as well as he can weld something else. A laborer can lay track just as well as he can do something else. A machinist can work on the under track, the wheels.